This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
This is the time of year when many college-bound high school students really start revving up their preparations for the SAT. There are dozens of courses and guidebooks designed to help, but do they really make a difference?
In a way, many students have been preparing for aspects of the test for a very long time.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a student who aced his SAT will tell us how he upped his score. Then we'll visit a school in San Francisco that has grade school students writing novels, playing songs, and learning to weld. And we'll spend an academic minute in the expanding world of wireless networks. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Jari Wong did what almost every high school junior dreams of doing, got a perfect score on his SAT. He took that score and took it to Duke University. He also helped write an SAT study guide called Up Your Score, the underground guide to the SAT. We spoke to Jari and asked when a student should really start getting ready to take the SAT.
I think that it'd be smart to start during the summer between sophomore and junior year, but I think, realistically speaking, because the skills being tested on the SAT really reflect some of the skills that you'll use constantly throughout life, that in a way, many students have been preparing for aspects of the test for a very long time. And so it's really necessary to start as early as possible to develop those reading and writing skills. And, you know, I know a lot of people might blow off school a little bit during, like, their freshman year of high school, but important to pay attention in class, make sure you do the homework, the math homework, because those are times where you could really improve those basic core skills that you need. And so you won't have to play catch up, you know, when you're cramming for the SAT. It'll just simply be more of a review.
There are a lot of courses available to help students prepare for the SAT. Did you take any of those?
No. During high school, I never really engaged in any of those test prep courses. I think I did once during middle school, actually, because it was just, you know, it was offered as part of this other program I was taking. And it was for the test that a lot of young people take because it's part of the CTY program. And you can qualify for, you know, a summer at the Center for Talented Youth. But beyond that, I found that session not particularly helpful to me, but I can't say the same for a lot of other people because, you know, it depends on the style of learning. Personally, I like to learn through integrating, you know, like if I wanted to learn new words, I wouldn't pore over a book necessarily and memorize lists, but instead I would go out and read and then search for words that I didn't know and then look at them in their context, and that's just the way I learn.
Did you hope that this book could replace or maybe supplement those test prep courses?
Yeah, I think absolutely, because most test prep books offer guidelines on how to approach specific types of problems. I mean, that's their point. But I think Up Your Score brings it into a different light. And it uses humor. It uses mnemonic devices to catch people's attention. I think one of the major flaws of regular test prep books is that they expect people to be able to sit through like 50 pages of just straight lists and definitions and still stay awake after like 2 minutes. When I started really focusing on the SAT, it was certainly like a month or two before the test. After the bit that I studied for in like eighth grade, I never really put much attention into it because there were just so many more ways to improve the same set of skills without focusing on prep books and stuff like that. And if you want, I'll go into a little bit about the types of activities that I did in high school, which certainly developed the same skills in a way that benefits you academically. It's pretty important to not only just read more reputable publications or magazines like National Geographic or Discover or, you know, Time Magazine, but also to keep a blog, a daily blog, because that really helps you emote and think aloud in many ways, especially if you try and focus on making that writing of good quality. Then that's a fast way to improve your writing, certainly. And in school, I participated in the newspaper. I wrote a column for that. And I was on the literary magazine board. So I knew going into high school that my reading comprehension and writing skills were definitely weaker than my math skills. And so I made a conscious effort to participate in activities that would improve that.
You talked about blogging. Do you agree with critics who say that spell check and texting shorthand impairs writing skills?
I think text messaging and going on IM Instant Messenger certainly hinders your ability to use like proper grammar. But I think in the case of blogging, if you make a conscious effort to keep a good blog and not rant in the same format as you would in a text message, that serves a really good role. And I personally myself, I have Zanga. There's also different types of blogs like people use often, like LiveJournal or things like that. And I subscribe to a lot of people that really structure their writing in their blog. And so it really reflects their true writing ability. And so if you make the conscious effort to do that, you know, pick a topic a day, write something you feel about it, you know, take 20 minutes to think out your writing process, and then go for it. I think doing things like that will definitely improve your writing.
Well, let's get into the actual test-taking. You say it's very important to keep track of your time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because there's this thing during the test, a lot of people will want to, and I think it's a mistake that even people who are experienced with test-taking make all the time, is when you hit a problem and you're absolutely convinced you know the answer, and so you just spend like, you know, you'll say to yourself, okay, just a couple more seconds, and seconds, of course, turn into minutes in absolutely no time. And so I think it's important that you glance and you're able to keep track and say, well, I've been working on this problem for, you know, 3-4 minutes. Even if I can do it, I'm just going to accept that I haven't done it and, you know, look forward to all those problems that need to be done. But I think keeping track of your time is definitely important.
And I see you say that guessing is not a bad idea.
Yeah, guessing is almost certainly a good idea. Myself, I'm a bit of a math nerd, so like I'll try to do a quick explanation in terms of mathematically why it's a good idea. So there's 5 choices for every problem, and you get 1 point for a right answer, and you get docked 1/4 point for a wrong one. So on an average of 5 answers, you'll probably have a net score over time of 0 points. So just if you just randomly guess all 5 questions, in the end you're going to end up with 0 points. On average. So if you can eliminate 2 or 3 answers, there's almost no reason not to guess. In most circumstances, it'll almost certainly improve your score in the long run than leaving all those things blank.
On your test, you pulled a perfect score. How many of those answers were guesses?
I'd say I guessed on about 3 or 4 of them, where I narrowed it down to 2 choices, and I really couldn't make up my mind.
So the odds worked for you.
Yeah, my odds were okay. I guess it would depend on how they scored it. I mean, sometimes they score extremely rigorously, and sometimes you can actually get a question wrong, I think, and still not, you know, get docked from the 800. I'm not quite sure how ETS scores it, but that can happen.
As you get further into the test, do the questions get harder?
Yeah, typically that's true, especially in mathematics. Sometimes in writing, in reading, you have to watch out that questions get harder to the end per passage. So it's not as if the passages themselves get harder. It's just the questions get harder sequentially. But that's not always the case. And I think some of the tips and tricks pointed out in the book would be to look at the types of questions being asked in reading comprehension passages. For example, questions in the beginning that ask about things encompassing the entire passage, you might want to hold off to until the end. So sometimes it can be advantageous to start on a medium level question and still work your way forward. You don't always have to start from the easiest question first or the supposedly the easiest question, because sometimes it's just strategy, good strategy.
Well, other than your regular test prep, how did you prepare physically? What kind of relaxation techniques or other things did you do?
Before I started taking the test, I basically just leaned back in my chair and just closed my eyes and stretched out a little bit. I get nervous easily, actually. And whenever I get nervous, I get these horrible stomach aches. that basically ruined my entire morning. So I was just dead focused on not getting nervous, and not so much about the test, but just not getting nervous. Because I knew that once I got nervous, things would just fall apart pretty quickly.
Finally, what about the PSAT? Is that a good idea to take that test?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If there's an opportunity for anybody to take the PSAT, certainly go for it, because I know my school offered it to all of our students for free. And the PSAT is also good because, I mean, if you score well on the PSAT, you can qualify for the National Merit Scholarship. So, I mean, there's good incentive. I think a lot of people would agree when I say that the SAT tests just as much test-taking skills as it does your true academic skills, because a lot of the SAT revolves around knowing your way around the test, understanding the test, and getting into the mind of people who make the test, which is a lot of what Up Your Score is about, getting into, you know, ETS's mind and how they think and how they develop their questions.
Jerry Wong is a co-author of the book Up Your Score, The Underground Guide to the SAT. It's published by Workmen Press. Still to come, there's a school in the Bay Area that is teaching grade schoolers to read, write, and weld. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1124. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. On a typical day at Brightworks, a private school in San Francisco's Mission District, students are welding, listening to indie music, and writing novels. The school opened its doors last September with a simple goal: trust your kids more. Nicole Jones reports.
Ahem. Ladies and gentlemen of Brightworks, I'd like to welcome you to this show of Margie Thinks He's a Murderer.
Snake, hide! I'm already hiding in a shush. I'm trying to sneak up on a friend.
No, I mean get in a bush. Get out of the area. There's a murderer out loose.
Oh, shush. Enough of those stories of yours.
See?
About 20 students at Brightworks School are sprawled out on beanbag chairs. Their classmates are performing a sock puppet play about some confused and supposedly murderous animals. Pretty normal stuff.
Yeah. Thanks so
great
much.
Set. Yeah, great, great dialogue, great puppets.
It was really funny. Skunk at the last minute. We had to pull together the puppet at the last minute.
Yeah. What do you guys?
This is the first ever class at Brightworks. 30 kids are enrolled, ranging in ages from 6 to 12. But this school does things a little differently.
This is a kindergarten where you know that your child is going to learn how to use a drill.
Brightworks School co-founder Gaver Tully thinks children are capable of more than we give them credit for.
This is a school where the answer is yes, you can learn how to use the chop saw. Yes, you can use the laser cutter. Yes, you can, you know, apprentice yourself to this potter. That's a perfectly good thing for a 12-year-old to do.
Brightworks doesn't ignore the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. It just takes its own approach to it. The school uses a curriculum Tully created called the ARC planning process. It has three phases.
The first one is exploration, where we're kind of trying to look at the topic from as many different perspectives as we can and bring in as many experts as we can.
Like engineers who make Japanese flutes out of PVC pipes, welders are magazine illustrators. The second phase is called expression. They take all these ideas and express them in some new way. Then the third phase is exposition, which is show and tell. Tully invented this approach to education with the Tinkering School, a summer camp he founded in 2004. Children could experiment with saws and drills to build anything from chairs to miniature roller coasters. If kids could dream it, they could build it. And if they failed, then, well, they tried.
That was the beginning of what you might call one of our pedagogical sort of pillars was this idea that when it's a shared exploration of the unknown, when the adults that are working with the children have as little idea as the kids do about whether or not this project is going to work, there's something magical about it.
The summer camp was such a success that Tully and his co-founder, Brian Welch, formed BrightWorks. The school doesn't just rethink traditional education, but modern views of childhood, too.
When did we think it was crazy to let a 12-year-old drive a tractor? When did we think it was crazy to let a 12-year-old carry a pocket knife? You know, what caused these changes? And was it possible that we were underestimating the nascent ability of children?
The school's in what used to be an old mayonnaise factory. Light floods the room from the mammoth windows and skylights. It's a big open space with a soft cork floor, perfect for bare feet. There's an arts area, electronics lab, wood workshop, and a kitchen where there's an ongoing project to develop the perfect BrightWorks potato chip. And then there's Kid City, a two-story plywood fort full of nooks and crannies.
Kid City was designed by the children, built by the children, to be their permanent sort of home within the school, their home away from home. They use that as a place of refuge when they're just mentally exhausted by some problem. They know they can just go there and read or draw.
The students help build just about everything in the school, from the partition walls to pieces of furniture. It's a sort of one-room schoolhouse, but instead of harking back to days on the prairie, the openness of the space reflects Tully's very 21st century vision.
It's a very honor the creative impulses of the children, create an environment that provokes and engages the children in activities that they might otherwise not engage in.
We don't do any tests, no grades, nothing like that.
10-year-old Elizabeth Seda Hathaway attends BrightWorks with her 6-year-old sister. She's been to a bunch of different schools, but she says so far, BrightWorks has been her favorite.
This is a free school. In my old school, you kind of had to do what the teacher told you to do. And here, you can kind of opt out sometimes. And I like how we don't have to do a lot of sitting down and listening to people, because that can be kind of boring. And yes, it can be very annoying.
It's so different than the public school I grew up with.
Rose Price is a collaborator at BrightWorks, in other words, a teacher. She's young but energetic, and it shows in her teaching style. She's more like an older, wiser friend to her students. It's a relationship that resonates with the kids.
It's what my mom always dreamed of for me, and something I always wanted for myself, like a place where learning actually was fun and almost invisible because it was so natural.
BrightWorks is a nonprofit private school and functions outside the jurisdiction of the California Department of Education. That means teachers at BrightWorks don't need teaching credentials and the students aren't required to take any standardized tests. Without this accreditation, there could be obstacles ahead for kids who try to transfer back into the public school system. Tully is very open about that and the fact that he does not have a background in traditional education.
What I am is kind of a savant educator. I have a handle on a unique insight into how to create engaging learning experiences.
Tully has a background in tech and worked at Adobe for years. Technology is at the core of a lot of learning at BrightWorks, so long as it's used as a tool.
One of the children in the early interviews asked me, could I bring my video game to school? And I said, well, I'm not comfortable with you bringing a video game, but I'm okay with you playing a video game. He said, really? I said, yeah. If you write a video game, you can play it. And so that process is unfolding.
BrightWorks is still in a stage of infancy, and what's next for these children after they graduate is uncertain. But Tully sees the lack of complete structure more of an opportunity rather than a challenge.
If you look at one of our youngest children right now, Clementine, by the time she graduates, she will have worked on somewhere between 50 to 70 projects taken from inspiration all the way to completion. When she graduates, she's going to have a much better idea about what it is she wants to do for a living in the classic sense of the term and the skills to back it up.
students will graduate with a multimedia portfolio-based diploma. Whether or not traditional high schools will see the years of work inside these portfolios as on par to other primary schools is not exactly clear. But if BrightWorks leaves you wishing you could go back to primary school, well, maybe you can. In the near future, they plan to offer night classes for children and adults in the Mission District. In San Francisco, I'm Nicole Jones for Cross Currents.
The use of wireless networks is expanding almost daily, and so is the technology supporting those networks. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. If you're using a smartphone, you can see the little 3G or 4G icon pop up when browsing outside a wireless network. The University of Notre Dame's Associate Professor of Electrical Engineering, J. Nicholas Laneman, explains how wireless networks are created and managed.
The exciting world of wireless. It may have become easy to take wireless technology for granted with the pervasiveness of cell phones, tablets, computers, televisions, speakers, smart meters, and so on, all connecting to each other in the internet using some flavor of wireless. It is an amazing time to enjoy the convenience and freedom of wireless connectivity, regardless of whether you're a geek like me or an everyday user like my mom. Yet all too often, our wireless devices do not just work, and we experience the data traffic jam called network congestion. One of the main reasons for wireless network congestion is that the radio frequency, or RF, spectrum is very crowded. RF spectrum is the natural resource for wireless systems, the supply side, and it has to be carefully managed in order to limit interference between different services. Managing spectrum has become very challenging in recent years with the explosive growth of cellular data services as well as the penetration of smartphones. But there are numerous innovations being developed and brought into the marketplace. As a few examples, innovative RF circuits and antennas can take advantage of untapped frequencies, wider bandwidths, or even multiple bands simultaneously. Multiple antenna systems can boost coverage and capacity without requiring additional frequencies. Small cell and heterogeneous network architectures can provide extra coverage and capacity in targeted areas. And dynamic spectrum access can allow so-called secondary users to share underutilized parts of the spectrum, provided they do not cause harmful interference to the primary users. Addressing the spectrum challenge and developing solutions are many of our nation's brightest minds at leading universities and in collaboration with industry and government agencies. This work is very important to the sustainability of our growing wireless world. Very exciting times if you don't take wireless for granted.
That was the University of Notre Dame's J. Nicholas Laneman. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.